Well, if there is something we've all learned this week and over the last couple of weeks, it's surely that our criminal courts are not equipped in their current form to deal adequately, fairly, with sexual assault cases, as the tally of how few reported to the police actually make it into the courts, and then how few again end up with a conviction. And we also know that so few victims of sexual abuse actually report it in the first place. On Q&A this week, one guest, Saxon Mullins, who's gone through the court system following her 2013 sexual assault, was asked whether she'd recommend others to report and go through the process she did. Here's what she said.
It's really personal to every survivor what they see as justice. You know, some people might not even consider going to the police or going through the court system. So, that's totally off the table from the word go. But it's really about judging what each survivor feels is justice. But if someone asks me, is it worth going through the policing process, the court process, I don't know that I can be a massive advocate for it because, like you said, it's a brutal system.
And Saxon is now a director of advocacy at the Rape and Sexual Assault Centre and Advocacy Institute. So, how to do it better? Can we genuinely rethink our rules, find other ways that will encourage victims of sexual abuse to come forward and be heard for some type of reckoning? Well, there is some good news. Work is underway, and examples from overseas might guide us as well. Joining me are three people with a keen interest and experience. Andrea Durbach, Emeritus Professor in the Faculty of Law at UNSW. She was Deputy Sex Discrimination Commissioner to Elizabeth Broderick. Then she was engaged by the Defence Force Abuse Task Force to develop the restorative engagement model framework in 2012. Kerry Carrington is Professor of Law at the School of Justice in the Queensland University of Technology, QUT. She's been researching how countries like Argentina deal with gender violence through specialised police units. And Tony North QC is chair of the Victorian Law Reform Commission, and they happen to be in the middle of an inquiry looking into the response of the justice system to sexual offences. He was a judge of the Federal Court for 23 years. So welcome to you all.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Thank you. Good morning.
I'd like to start by asking all three of you why you think the criminal court process is failing victims of sexual abuse. I just want to hear it, your own summary. First to you, Andy Durbach.
Good morning, Geraldine. Well, as Saxon Mullins, I think, so eloquently stated, you know, it's a system that can work well in some situations and where justice is served. But I think from the starting point for many complainants, just the actual process of investigation, many of the investigative skills amongst our police force, who I think in general are pretty amazing, but they're inappropriate, they're inadequate to deal with this kind of unlawful conduct or trauma. I think there's huge fear that people won't be believed, that there may be breaches of confidentiality, that people feel they will be re-traumatized by going through the system where the standard of proof, which it needs to be, is pretty high beyond a reasonable doubt, and you're dealing with issues around consent. So I think there are many, many factors which are stacked against complainants who dare to come into this world where they're going to be tested and the veracity of what happened to them tested in a highly emotive, highly traumatic situation.
Right. And Tony North, how would you answer that question?
Well, Geraldine, there is a very basic fundamental conundrum that we have to face, and that is that we have a system which requires proof beyond reasonable doubt. And that standard is applied in cases, these types of cases, where it's mostly word against word. So juries acting conscientiously have this problem where they hear the story of one person, then they hear the story of the other. They ask themselves, do I have a reasonable doubt? And so often they say, well, how can you not have a reasonable doubt where you've just got one person saying yes and the other person saying no? So, you know, that is a terribly, terrible, difficult mountain to climb. Mm. And we've been looking at this in the Victorian Law Reform Commission since April last year, when we got a reference from the Attorney General. We've had 70 submissions and 50 consultations with people, stakeholders in the system. And what we've seen is that There's been massive changes over two decades. The Commission looked at this same issue in 2004, and as a result, there were lots of improvements trying to wrestle with this conundrum. You know, we've got jury directions. Judges are required to tell juries, for instance, that delay in reporting doesn't mean that the allegations should be disbelieved. We've had, you know, systems where witnesses, complainants can give evidence remotely. We've got laws which require barristers to treat witnesses properly without asking insulting questions. We've got the use of video evidence so that it can be, their evidence can be captured early in the piece, you know, whilst memory is fresh. We've had, I mean, Victoria has been, I must say, magnificent in trying to get an answer to that conundrum. And it hasn't really advanced matters very far. Where it's sort of stunning how little progress has been made. And it might be because there's an immovable mountain in our way. What we are finding, and, you know, we're reporting to the attorney in August, so I'm talking about the state of our current investigation rather than final sort of views about it. But we've analysed, or had analysed, a number of court transcripts in rape cases. And what we're finding is that despite these reforms, they're actually not translated into the way court cases are conducted.
Goodness.
And principally the conduct of, I call them dinosaur counsel, that is barristers who grew up in the age where you aim to discredit complainants by belittling them, confusing them, and making them just look ridiculous. Now, that's not the way younger modern barristers work. That comes out clearly, but it is the way older ones work, and of course older judges. So it might be that that's still the remaining barrier.
Okay. Now, I'm going to come back, and I want to give Kerry a chance, because I know you've been looking at this for a while, Kerry. How would you answer the question?
Okay, I've been studying this for three decades, Geraldine, and good morning to all the viewers. Well, for a start, there's over 2 million Australians who have been victimised by sexual assault. That's a lot. Only 1% of those will probably ever get justice. And so I kind of gave up several decades ago seeking justice in the justice system because it's completely stacked against the complainants. In an adversarial justice system, Tony's right and so is Andrea. The complainants are there not as victims, they're there as witnesses for the Crown, and so their full story can never be heard. They are subjected to rhetorical jousting. They're usually these witnesses are in the cross-examined by barristers the longest in any case, sometimes up to 3 days. They may be accused of being a liar hundreds of times in that 3 days of fabricating. But what the whole entire trial system does is it can feed into the narrative of rape culture, which protects perpetrators, that is, women cannot be believed. They cry wolf. They're never to be believed. And, of course, this is a narrative that's embedded in our culture and wider in culture. And, of course, this is judges and barristers and the whole system and jurors. They're all part of that. So until we change the myths of rape culture that are stacked against complainants, we're never really going to get a change in the system. I like Tony, I've been totally frustrated by the absolute lack of change. Our sexual assault rates are actually going up. That could be a good thing. It could be more reporting, although I don't think so. My suspicion is that we're just getting worse.
Okay. All right. So that just, I can just hear from all of you then. I mean, there's various questions I want to ask, but I do want to get to some specific changes. Andrea, you've been working with the Australian Defence Force And I wonder what are the, you say that in with gender violence, there needs to be a two-prong approach in order to achieve change, to cut through some of this that we've just heard. What are the two prongs that have to be used?
Geraldine, I did this work in 2012, 2013, so it's quite some time ago now. And it came out of the real frustration that both Kerry and Tony speak to about the criminal justice system not actually delivering the kind of justice and the redress that many complainants need. And it was, as you say, was located within the Defence Force, where there was a culture of terrible assault and harassment and bullying. And it came out of a desire not only to provide redress for the victim and acknowledgement of what had happened to the complainants or the survivors, but also it's pointless just going endlessly around the same circle of redress and remediation and repair if you're not actually dealing with the institution or the structure or the societal structures that are enabling this conduct in the first place. So when you speak to this two-prong approach, what we developed was something called the Restorative Engagement Program, where we recognize the need for acknowledgement and repair and redress for victims or complainants who came forward, but at the same time, the need for real accountability and transformation of the institutions that enabled this kind of behavior. So there was some sort of accountability involved. And the Restorative Justice Program takes its lead really from a lot of the principles underlying restorative justice, but it's a hybrid model that we developed, which brought in notions of conciliation and mediation. And where we differed from the sort of classical restorative justice framework was the perpetrator wasn't involved in that engagement or that conference with the victim.
Who was involved then?
It was a representative, a fairly senior representative of the institution, the Defence Force. Because our argument was that if you wanted to change the structures and the culture that where there was a kind of impunity, a culture of impunity, and almost to go to Tony's point earlier, a kind of a sort of emboldening of behavior by degrading other. It was always quite amazing to me that somehow people feel honored in the humiliation of other. And we had to stamp that out. And I think by bringing senior members of the Defence Force face-to-face with people who'd experienced this horrendous trauma and harm in an institution which prides itself on protecting our citizens, it was transformative, absolutely transformative.
So it kept outside the criminal system, and by the sound of you, people making their case felt heard, so there was dignity there. Were charges laid, and was there a compensation? Like, did the institution, so affected as you say they often were, did they, did the people wish to be recompensed or just heard?
Well, it was a mixture, Geraldine. And I think the important point to make is that before these people even came into a conference, they had to meet a certain threshold, not of the criminal system standard, not beyond a reasonable doubt, but well heard and believed. And so they came into these conferences where the abuse and harm alleged by them was accepted as an undisputed event. And that was huge. So there was acknowledgement from the start. And then there was this process of what can we do to repair? And many of the people who came forward, yes, there was compensation available. There was counselling available. It was a multifaceted, very, very well-rounded framework.
So quite expensive for the organisation concerned.
Pretty resource-intensive, but necessarily so. In my view, is that if you're going to meet the needs of redress and acknowledgement on the one hand and transformation and change in the culture on the other, you need to invest resources, not only financial, but human. And I think the engagement of senior members of the Defence Force and the willingness of these men and women to come and sit in these conferences and participate for days on end was pretty remarkable.
And did the perpetrator ever arrive? Because, I mean, that's the interesting thing with restorative justice, with youth work, which is, I think, only to do with property cases. It's not to do with personal injury. I think that used to be the case anyway. But the business of perpetrator sitting in the same room as victim, now that's a tricky one. Sometimes it worked exceptionally well, strangely enough. But I don't know in cases of sexual assault.
No, and we took a very strong view that that was not the restorative justice model we would adopt. It was a hybrid model, as I say. Mm. The perpetrator was not part of the process, and if there were criminal, there was a foundation for a criminal investigation, that would be dealt with by the criminal justice system, right, or indeed through the disciplinary procedures of the Defence Force.
Is this something you're looking at, Tony North, the process of restorative justice?
Yes, we are, Geraldine, but not quite in the same context as Andrea. That is, we're not looking at the institutional environment. We're looking at having restorative justice as an option, as Saxon Mullins talked about, you know, how does justice look to the individual? Now, you imagine the common, unfortunately, case of intrafamilial sexual violence, and you've got maybe uncle or grandpa abusing their family members, it all comes out. Is the criminal justice system really useful to the people involved? Do they really want uncle or grandpa to go to jail? Or do they want to sit down and have an acknowledgement of the harm that's been done as a result of that activity? And, you know, we've been struck by the fact that this process is not going to be appropriate for very many cases. You know, the parish priest who molests dozens of people. I mean, no one is suggesting that it's a good idea to sit down with them and try and heal for the future. Mm. But there will be cases, and I always think that if we can help six families in a year by a system, it's worthwhile doing. We have other ideas. We've got truth-telling, conferencing, which has sort of been it's allied to what we presently have in the victims of crime system, where people go along, the perpetrators are not involved, they're seeking compensation, and the feedback we get is that the process of talking to authority, being believed, being accepted, is quite transformative. So it might be for some victims that that's what justice looks like. Mm. And we're even looking at the idea of encouraging in one way or another civil redress, that is bringing civil proceedings. The standard of proof is on the balance of probability, so it'd be easier to get results, and maybe some state funding at one level or another, we're a little uncertain at the moment, of that type of process where the perpetrator will be held to account financially. So, yes, you know, we're trying to find different ways to answer that cry for justice that Saxon was talking about.
Yes, and I might add with the, I know that in the military case, there were a lot of men also came forward, you know, who were complaining, yes, of assault. Now, look, I do want to go to another very interesting, a tangential result of the need for structural change. Kerry, you've been involved in researching what's happening in countries like Argentina and how the police deal with sexual abuse there. How are they doing it differently?
Chalk and cheese to Australia. I've been researching it for many years. I've had an Australian Research Council grant for the last three. They in 1988, in a period of redemocratisation, they had a truth-telling commission. And it's interesting that this women's police stations model was born of that. Argentina is a very innovative country. They invented transitional justice. That's the components of what both Andrea and Tony have just been talking about. That was originally invented in Argentina in the 1980s, in the period of redemocratization. Then it travelled around the world, and it's been truth-telling has become a form of healing and a form of justice. And so out of that, then emerged this, well, the criminal justice system's never going to give justice to justice, particularly victims of sexual assault and largely to domestic violence, and especially when they don't want their family members to go to jail. They don't want criminal justice proceedings, but they do need a reckoning. They do need justice. Something has to happen to stop it from continuing to happen. So what they did was they invented what in Spanish are called Comisaría de la Mujer, which means police for women, and they have been translated into English as women-only police, but they're not. They do employ male police, and they can accept male victims. It's just that primarily the police who work there are women, and primarily the victims are women. Now, they work in a multidisciplinary model. They've managed to,
they've got their own command structure, haven't they? Their own commissioners.
They have their own complete command structure. So in you have the common police, and then you have one in five police stations is a specialist police station designed to receive victims and victims only. And they have a whole of government approach. They have social workers, counsellors. So the person who wants to go and seek help will be triaged at the beginning, and whether they want counselling, what they need. Do they want to see a lawyer? Do they want to see a police officer? All that happens. And then they also run survivors groups, and only one third of the victims who seek their assistance go down the criminal justice path.
Interesting.
Because they get reckoning through an alternative, reckoning of the kinds that both Tony and Andrew have been talking about. They get it through truth-telling, being believed. And when you walk into those women's police stations, they have massive murals that have been painted by survivors, and they say, "Yo te creo," which means we believe you, I believe you, I believe you. They have it everywhere, because that is what makes so many victims be able to come to a reckoning. It's not revenge they want, it's a reckoning, it's a healing.
Well, I mean, this is so interesting, Andy Durbach, isn't it? Because in a way, the great tradition of British justice certainly has been that we do test people's, everybody gets the chance to argue their case. It's as if it's suddenly, it's hitting this particularly intimate area of sexual behaviour, which I suppose is exactly what you were trying to deal with the military.
Well, yes, because many people think of it as some sort of private crime that we shouldn't be talking about or shouldn't be exposed. There's a discomfort with that, despite it's very endemic to many societies, because it comes out of an inequality and exertion of power and coercion. So I do think these new ways of looking at it are going to be the way forward. I actually think what Kerry's talking about also speaks to something that we so need to happen, which I think our country is now facing, and that's the prospect of some national summit that will lead to what Kerry talks about as a reckoning. We have to have, the conversation is out there now, and what leadership in our country needs to do is actually say to women, to bring the experts, to bring the women together. We've had enough inquiries, and we know what's happening, we've got the evidence. Now we need the experts, the psychologists, the police, the artists, the lawyers to come together to actually form some way of approaching this, given what we all started saying at the start, that the criminal justice system is failing very, very, very many women and men in this country.
Look, I think we'll leave it there, because there's very much a lot, obviously, more work to be done. But I thank you all very much indeed for agreeing to come on and talk about this. Tony North from Victorian Law Reform Commission, it'll be very interesting to see your report in August.
Yes, thank you, Geraldine.
I wish you luck. And Kerry Carrington from QUT, thank you to you.
Oh, thank you, Geraldine, for giving me this opportunity to share the results of our research.
And Andy Durbach from the Faculty of Law at the University of New South Wales, thanks very much for your time as well.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Thank you. Thank you.
And look, yes, you've been acknowledging how good it is to have a conversation like this on the text line. So look, we'll do more because there are some very interesting work underway too about the particularly the different ways, sort of specific areas of restorative justice that's being carried out in New Zealand. Very, very interesting. So we're going to we'll come back to that as well.